Okay, I'm going to get to the trees. The theme, you know, I've been at this a long time, but the theme that I come down to now is a very, very simple one. The challenge for us is to reinsert ourselves back into our home, planet Earth, and realize that we are interconnected and interdependent. We forget the most primary reality is that we're still biological creatures. We're animals. And you know, it's funny, some people get really pissed off at me when I tell an audience that we're animals. You know, don't tell my Mary she's an animal, we're human beings. You know, we think that we're somehow disconnected from those critters, we're different. Well, we are animals. And as animals, if we don't have clean air, clean water, clean soil that gives us our food, clean energy from the sun, and a diversity of other living things that are our genetic relatives, we're in deep trouble. And we forget that, I believe, at our peril. So the great challenge now for us is to realize that we live in this wonderful world and we are interdependent on the rest of nature for our well-being and our survival. Now, as I said at the beginning, I've always been an animal guy. My interest when I was a kid were insects and fish. I wanted to be an entomologist at one time, and then I wanted to be an ichthyologist because you could do experiments and then eat your experiments when you were finished with them. And because animals move, they're flashy, they make noise, they're cute and cuddly. And although my parents were both avid gardeners, to me gardening was I had to do my chores, come home at night, dig trenches, put compost in, and I had to weed and all that stuff. I hated gardening. And I always took plants for granted. Even in all the battles that I've been involved in for many, many years to stop clear-cut logging, my concern was really forests as ecosystems, as habitat for a spectrum of people and wanting to maintain the integrity of forests. We take trees for granted. They're always a backdrop, you know, like we're leaning on them now, and when the sun's out, we try to get under the trees for shade, and we climb in them, and we hack off branches if we want, and cut them down if we want, without ever a second thought. I was sitting on, we have a cottage on Quadra Island, and down just above the beach, where the soil ends, is an immense Douglas fir. And we use that Douglas fir all the time because it's got a strange shape. It comes out of the bank horizontal like this. And then so it's perfect for sitting in and playing. And then it curves up and then it goes straight up. So it's got this weird shape. And Bob drew a picture of a picture I sent him of that tree. It's in the introduction here. And, you know, we hang hammocks from it and we hang from it and string ropes from it. We do all sorts of things. Never thought about it until one day I was thinking, you know, that's really weird. Why is that tree coming out of the ground horizontal? Well, it must have started its life at the top of above the beach, and the land must have slumped. So it slumped down, and it was still a young tree. And so naturally, all trees want to go head towards the sun. So once it slumped down, it started to curve up. But then it must have slumped a second time, so that now the base of the tree was horizontal, but it managed to go up like that. And that's what got me thinking about, you know, what a hell of a life a tree has. I mean, all these seeds get tossed out, and wherever it lands, it can't pick up and move and say, this is a crummy piece of soil, I want to go somewhere else. They're stuck wherever they are. So 99% of them never make it, because they land in the water, they land on rocks, they land in crummy places. But a tiny fraction will land perhaps with a tiny bit of soil. And any one of you who has ever seen trees along the coast of BC coming out of what looks like solid rock, you got to look at that and say, my God, what a precarious place to make a living. And then once they get their little root down there, they've got to get everything they need to live for hundreds of years and stay in that place and grow to be some of the largest critters on the planet. That, when you start thinking about it, is amazing. Because what are they going to do to make a living? They've got to get all the water they need. They need lots of water. They've got to get all of the nutrition, the minerals, and whatever elements they need to make these massive trees. And they need energy in order to keep the whole thing going. And they've all got to get it in that one spot. And when something comes to eat them, they can't duck or fight. They're just stuck there like this. When the storms blow and fires come, I mean, they just have to take it all, and they persist. That tree on my property must be 500 to 600 years old. And Douglas firs will go, as you know, over 1,000 years. You start thinking of it that way, and you think, my God, a tree is truly a miracle. And that's what got me to thinking, I want to write a book about that one tree. And the minute you do that, you realize, in order to explain how that tree got there and is living, I have to go right back to the Big Bang, to the beginning of the universe, 15 billion years ago, to explain how matter was formed out of that immense cauldron as the universe began to expand and matter began to precipitate out. And then about 5 billion years ago, we got our planet coalescing and becoming a distinct entity around the sun that had kicked into action. And then you realize, well, life arose about 3.8 to 4 billion years ago. And for hundreds of millions of years, those tiny bacteria had to make a living by just trying to find whatever energy they could scrounge, you know, a hot geyser or some kind of deep sea vent, and take the heat out of that and use that. It was a tough existence until bacteria discovered, hey, there's all that sunlight. And we can capture that sunlight, use sunlight, convert it into sugar, and we can store that energy as sugar, and we can use that energy and make all the parts of our bodies we need. So that photosynthesis was a tremendous innovation that bacteria made. And of course, what happened with photosynthesis is that over long periods of time, they began to remove carbon dioxide from the air and give back a thing that we animals think is important called oxygen. Before plants arose on the planet, you couldn't breathe the air because it was poisonous. And plants created the oxygen-rich atmosphere that we depend on, and they continue to do that to this day. The problem we have with climate today is that for the last 150 years, we've been burning fossil fuels at an increasing rate, adding way more carbon dioxide than all of the green things on Earth can reabsorb. And so carbon dioxide levels are now over 32% higher than they were 150 years ago, and that's trapping heat and warming the planet. Anyway, I didn't want to get into climate change. That's a whole two-hour speech. But plants then, bacteria, cyanobacteria, invented photosynthesis, and in the process transformed the atmosphere into one that animals could depend on. Photosynthesis was such a powerful thing that some bacteria said, hey, I'd really like the energy that you're getting by trapping that sunlight. So here, I'm going to open myself up. How about popping into my body? I'll protect you if you give me some of that sugar that you're capturing from the sun. And so we established a relationship between cyanobacteria and non-photosynthesizing bacteria until those green things, green bacteria, became integrated completely into the bodies of their host and became what we call chloroplasts, or cytoplasmic organelles. So plants became possible by the cooperation of non-photosynthesizing bacteria and absorbing photosynthesizers and giving them a home. So that's a miraculous association that I think, when you think about, we think of evolution as, you know, nature, red in tooth and claw, and competition, survival of the fittest. I think what plants show is that cooperation is at the heart of our capacity for survival. So that all of the plants really are cooperations or cooperatives of photosynthetic bacteria inside the cells of their hosts. Once you've got the oceans filled with photosynthesizing organisms, then competition got heavy, and a few critters found a way, plants found a way, when they got washed up on the shore, they could survive on land. And just think, when you got on the land, there were no competitors, and all that sunlight blasting down on you. And so soon, the whole terrestrial parts of the planet were covered in plants. And once you coat the Earth with plants, the problem is, now you're all kind of stuck with little room. How the hell do you get an advantage? Well, you start growing up higher. Start growing up towards the sun. But the problem is, if you start growing up and you're like a seaweed plant, you just flop over, right? The great invention that made trees possible was woodiness. You make wood. Now, what a dirty mind someone has of them. you now get a stiffening. Oh shit, I'm sorry. You now get. Anyway, wood was the great invention of plants that allowed trees to be possible to grow higher and higher. So you see that what a tree does, if you reflect on that tree and why it came and how it came to be, you realize that you have to go right back to the beginning of the universe in order to put it in its perspective. As I began to research for this book, there were a million questions I had to ask then as a simple-minded biologist. I hadn't thought about it. You know, how the hell, when a seed lands in the right place that it can germinate, how does it know which way is up? I mean, it's got to know which way is up because the roots got to go down and the leaves have got to, and the stems have got to go up. How does a plant know that? They don't always land the right side up. And then once it gets, the root gets digging down, you know, how does it absorb enough water and how does it get all of the enough nutrition? I'm not going to answer this for you. You got to buy the book to find the answers. And how does this thing stand there and survive in the middle of winter when everything's frozen around and tolerate the heat of the summer and take the storms that lash and the fires that periodically blow go through the forest? The answers to that are absolutely mind-boggling. The story that is told in the book that's wonderful is, you know, in Europe, especially in France, there is a magical, very important food called a truffle, which is very, very highly regarded. You know, they use pigs that are trained to find truffles, and the reason why pigs are trained to find truffles is that the truffles make truffles, which are the fruiting body of fungus. The truffles make a compound that smells like a sex hormone to pigs. So the pigs root out the truffles because they think they're going to get laid. And the president or the king of France decided, we've got to use French science. This is hundreds of years ago. We've got to use French science and find a way of growing truffles. So he got a scientist working on this. And what this scientist found was an amazing thing. Around the roots of trees are unbelievable networks of fungus. Thin strands that they're like around each tiny root. And you know, you have hundreds of miles of roots, root hairs, growing out of each plant, each tree. But even that's not fine enough to come into contact with the grains of sand and soil to extract everything. What you have around each very microscopic rootlet is, I think of it as a gauze. You know, when you cut your finger, you can find these gauzes that go on top and bandage your finger. Well, what happens is you get this mesh of fungus that covers each of the little rootlets and provides you many, many, many more times exposure to our surface area to come into contact with the surroundings. And what the scientists found was the organisms which are called mycorrhizal fungi. And all trees have a spectrum of fungi. Some of them are only found in specific species. I think Douglas fir, we say, has about 1,000 different species of fungus that are associated with them. Now, why does this matter? Well, the fungi can dissolve things out of the rock and the matrix of soil around. And they absorb this, and they trade with the roots of the trees. So they have this mutual thing where they say, we're going to extract this stuff that you need, but you've got to give us sugar back in return. So the roots of the tree, which get sugar made in the leaves high above the ground, then and transported back in, they trade sugar with the fungus in return for what the fungus extracts from the soil around. We didn't even know that existed. You know, and anyway, there are all kinds. When fire goes over, the question is, how do you replenish the soil fungi that are killed by the heat that comes across the soil? It turns out that we have mice in the forest that are extremely territorial, and when they're driven out by fire, as soon as the fire's over, they come back. And what they do is they start digging down to find truffles. And they eat the truffles, and above the surface, as they go about and defecate all over, they reseed the forest with the mycorrhizal fungi spores that the trees need in order to extract. I mean, see, so it's relationship upon relationship of interdependence and interconnection. We come along, we have no idea about that complexity. We think we'll take a forest, simplify it, and exploit it the way we want. We have a wonderful story in the book that is based on work that Tom Reimken at the University of Victoria is doing. One of the great I've gotten way too long. We've got, who else is following?
Rex Weiler.
He's a great book that's just come out. So I hope if you're at all intrigued by this, you'll realize that just taking the life of a single tree ends up connecting you not just to the entire area around here, but right around to the whole, throughout the whole universe. So thank you very much for listening.
Sellers booth just down there, so if you want to talk to him again, just sign his books, that kind of thing, just head over there.
Isn't science cool? Don't you wish you had him for a teacher? Well, you do. Every week on CBC Television, The Nature of Things. Thanks very much, David Suzuki. And as Susan mentioned, he'll be signing books at the back, and I'm sure he'll be happy to talk to you as well.